Whether you say zoonosis or zoonosis is not the point. It's a word we hear more and more now. We're talking about infectious diseases that spread from animals to humans on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This pandemic is forcing us to face just how much we humans have altered nature. A science writer has sounded the alarm for decades. David Quammen writes, viruses have no malice against us. They have no purposes, no schemes. They follow the same simple Darwinian imperatives as do rats or any other creature driven by a genome. That is, to extend themselves as much as possible in abundance. What do you want to know about diseases transferring from animals to humans? What about bats? What about wet markets? COVID-19. We're at 800-642-1234. David Quammen has been a science journalist for 40 years. He's the author of 16 books, including Spillover from 2012, that explores why diseases pass from animals to people more frequently. David, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, Kate. Good to be with you. Wisconsin is home turf for my family. I always enjoy talking with Wisconsin Public Radio.
Oh, well, it's so good that you're here. The pandemic has now killed at least 1 million people worldwide. It's the actual death toll is probably way worse. And, you know, we got here in just 9 months after the first reported fatality in China last January. With pandemics being your focus, what are you thinking now about COVID?
Well, I'm asking myself and asking scientists a couple of questions. How did this begin? Where did it come from? Why did it succeed so well, this virus? I'm frustrated with the degree that it has succeeded, especially in the U.S. The only thing really that's been surprising to me about this whole thing is not that a pandemic virus came out of a wild animal, maybe a bat, and threatened the world, but how unprepared we were to deal with it, particularly in the U.S., but elsewhere in the world, too. That's the part that's been surprising. I thought with all the warnings that had been issued by scientists over the previous 10 or 15 years, I thought we would be better prepared than this.
How could we be more prepared? Where are we falling down?
Well, the very first thing that surprised me in terms of lack of preparedness was our failure to have adequate diagnostic test kits ready. Accurate, abundant, and fast testing, including at airport security points. I expected that to be there. 10 years ago, a scientist in New York, a very fine molecular evolutionary scientist, told me that his lab was working on technology to create this sort of portable real-time test kits where you would get the sequence, the genomic sequence of a new virus. You would put it on a chip. You would have that available at airport checkpoints very quickly so that people could be tested with a simple the same kind of swabs that we do now, simple cheek swab or nose swab, that could be inserted into this machine. And then the time that it took a person to take off her shoes, take her laptop out, put it on the belt, go through the X-ray screening, come out the other side, reassemble, authorities would know whether that person was positive or negative for the new virus. I was in Australia, Tasmania, until early March, and when I flew home on March 2nd, I expected to start to see that sort of thing, and it didn't exist, and it hasn't existed yet.
You know,
that's just the first of many surprises in terms of lack of preparedness.
You know, David, there are nearly 8 billion of us on this planet. Why is this virus succeeding? Why can't we knock it down?
Well, this virus in several ways is the nightmare virus. It's a coronavirus, as everyone famously knows. Scientists were warning against coronaviruses 10 years ago. I warned against them in my book in 2012, echoing the warnings of the scientists that I heard. The prototype for this was SARS-1, the SARS virus that emerged from southern China in 2002, 2003. Spread quickly from the Hong Kong airport to Toronto and some other places, infected 8,000 people and killed 800, and then it was stopped. It was very scary to disease scientists, but it was stopped by good, rigorous public health measures. But one of the reasons it could be stopped is because it did not have silent spread. It had a high case fatality rate, but it didn't have what this virus has, which is the capacity to spread from people who feel just fine, who don't recognize that they're infected, don't feel sick, so they're walking around, they're going to work, they're riding the subway, and at the same time, they're shedding virus. That's one of the things that has made this virus so successful. Another, frankly, is its low case fatality rate, because some people haven't taken it seriously enough. It doesn't kill, in most cases, 10% of the people it infects. It might only kill 1% or less. And so people, including some of our fearless leaders, have been able to dismiss it for months, saying it's not serious. And now what do we have? 1 million deaths.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with David Quammen, who's a longtime science journalist, wrote the book Spillover about the origins and consequences of infectious diseases. He's taking your questions about zoonotic diseases and what you see at 800-642-1234. David, how did you go down this path decades ago? How did you start to explore zoonotic diseases and what they could do?
Well, there's a little story there. 21 years ago, I was asked by National Geographic to cover an expedition across the last great dense forests of Central Africa in the Congo Basin and the Ogooué Basin. A fellow named Mike Fay, an intrepid American ecologist and explorer and conservationist, was going to walk 2,000 miles through these forests in a pair of sandals and river shorts. And National Geographic asked me to follow him, write three stories, follow him not for the whole trip, but for sections of it. So a photographer and I, a wonderful fellow named Nick Nichols, and I did that, and we produced these three stories. At one point, I was walking with Faye through a stretch of forest in northeastern Gabon that we knew to be Ebola territory, a forest in which the Ebola virus lived, hiding in some sort of a non-human creature, because all viruses need a non-human host. They need a cellular creature. Otherwise, they can't replicate. That's just the way viruses are. So we're walking through this forest. We're sleeping on the forest floor. We're slogging through swamps and crossing blackwater streams. And we know that Ebola is with us there somewhere. But we didn't know where it was, what animal it was in. That got me interested in the ecology and evolution of Ebola virus. I started reading about this whole category of diseases, zoonotic diseases, diseases that pass from non-human animals into humans. I found out that 60% of our infectious diseases fall into this category, so it's not a minor, strange, weird thing at the edge of science. It's right dead center in the middle of science and medicine.
And you found on this expedition that gorillas near the village had fallen ill, had died, and that too was a warning for you.
That's right. That's right. Science knew by then that Ebola was lethal, not just to humans, but also to great apes, to gorillas and chimpanzees. There were a couple of fellows along with us, a couple of Gabonese fellows who were with us as field crew. There were 12 African men who worked with this fellow, carrying his gear and helping him identify plants and setting up camps and doing various things. So one evening I was around the campfire with a couple of these guys, and they started telling me about this outbreak of Ebola in their village back in 1996 and how horrible it had been, killing their loved ones, making a lot of people sick. And then one of them, his name was Tony, told me, yes, and at the same time that this was happening to our village, my friend and I saw a pile of 13 dead gorillas nearby in the forest. And that went right into my notebook. He was talking in French. My French is not great, but I got it down.
We have to pause there with science journalist David Quammen, who's our guide to the risks of spillover of zoonotic diseases. We'll be back in a moment. Stay with us here in the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're discussing diseases and infections that are transmitted between animals and people. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. According to the World Health Organization, it's estimated that globally, about 1 billion cases of illness and millions of deaths occur every year from zoonoses. These are infectious diseases caused by bacteria, by viruses, fungi, parasites that pass from animals to humans. So what questions do you have about this transmission? Where do you see the intersection of climate change and zoonotic diseases? Join in 800-642-1234. We have science journalist David Quammen, who made predictions about the next pandemic back in 2013, and he stays with us. Let's take a call. Now, Tim is joining us from Middleton. Hi, Tim.
Hi, I just wanted to thank the author for writing the book. I read that in March when everything was starting to get a little wild, and I was wondering if he could comment on the spread of the first SARS, how they were finding it was aerosolized and spreading more than 6 feet, and if he has any comments on the current CDC guidelines of
aerosol droplets.
Aerosol or droplet.
Yeah. Tim, yeah. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you, Tim, for that. Well, the first SARS, as I said, 2002, 2003, came out of southern China. Part of what happened with the first SARS was that nobody recognized at the beginning what a dangerous and airborne infection it was, so that there were a few patients that were having respiratory crises in a hospital in southern China and a hospital in Hong Kong, and they were surrounded by healthcare workers trying to intubate them. We've all heard about being intubated now. But in the course of trying to intubate this one man, he became known as the Poison King. Something like 24 healthcare workers were infected. They weren't wearing PPE. Now that happened elsewhere, happened in Toronto, happened in Beijing, where healthcare workers were particularly at risk because so little was known early on, and this was being spread to them by patients who came to be known as super spreaders, or these super spreader events. Again, we've heard about them now, where one patient shedding a lot of virus infects quite a large number of people.
Tim, thank you for the call. You know, I'm wondering, David, what causes a virus to jump to another species? You know, what happens in that transmission?
Yeah, well, in a single word, opportunity. You quoted me earlier, Kate, from, I think that was from my New York Times op-ed from a week or two, about, you know, viruses don't have goals. They don't have purposes. They don't have malice toward us. They simply tumble from one circumstance into another, from one situation, from one habitat, you could say, into another. So if a virus is being carried by, say, a population of bats, it's lived in that population of bats for a million years, it's reached an accommodation, it no longer causes symptoms in those bats, it's living at relatively low concentrations, then along comes a human, cuts down the trees that those bats are roosting in, or maybe catches some bats for food, or maybe just shovels up some bat guano, the virus from the bats can get into the human. It doesn't seek the human. It tumbles into the human or spills over into the human. And then if it's lucky, it finds that it can replicate in that first human. And then if it's twice lucky, it finds that it can transmit from human to human, and suddenly it has a whole new realm of opportunity. It has the possibility of infecting almost 8 billion individuals around the planet.
And so, you know, things have to happen along the way, and conditions have to be just right for this almost happenstance to happen.
That's right. That's right. And some scientists say that this virus possibly was pre-adapted to replicating in humans. This virus enters human cells with a certain kind of attachment, a certain kind of protein, a certain kind of handle on the outside of certain respiratory cells. And the virus grabs hold of that handle and gets in. Humans have that handle on their cells. Bats have that handle. Ferrets have that handle. Cats have that handle, which is one of the reasons we've seen cats get infected. Mink have that. Mink have been dying across Europe. So if a virus is adapted broadly enough to different kinds of creatures and different kinds of cells in different creatures, then there is a greater chance that it can move from one kind of host, one species of host, into another. Not every kind of virus has that capacity, but this one clearly does.
We're talking with David Quammen, who has been a science writer, science author for decades, and he has a number of publications. He's our guide to zoonotic diseases, taking your questions at 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Mary now, joining us from Pewaukee with a question. Hi, Mary.
Yes, hi. Thank you for the opportunity. Great to talk with you, David. And Kate, I wanted to mention that from what I've heard, and fact check me, that administrations prior, I thought the Obama administration had pandemic supplies, et cetera, and a procedure and things in place prior to this current administration that kind of got rid of it. That's what I heard. That could be a lie. The second thing that I wanted to bring up is why Wisconsin is so bad at trying to follow, you know, some rules and etiquette and common sense, and, you know, denying Evers his right to have us all wear masks so that we can save lives. I mean, I just don't get it. We went to a restaurant, and there was hardly anyone in there, and the server's eyes went rolled back in her head when she found out that we requested a mask.
Well, Mary, thanks. Were we better prepared in past administrations, David, for what we are facing today?
Yeah, thank you for that, Mary. Yes, we were better prepared. It began not with President Obama, but with President Bush, George W. Bush. There had been warnings, including the SARS, original SARS outbreak, 2003, bird flu in 1997. And so George Bush initiated some efforts at national preparedness. Those were continued under Barack Obama. There was established, among other things, a Directorate of Pandemic Preparedness within the National Security Council, and it was charged with preparing us for exactly this kind of event. And then under the current administration, that Directorate of Pandemic Preparedness was essentially gutted and dismantled so that we did not have that anymore. That was one of the problems. Mary also mentioned resistance to masks in Wisconsin. I can't speak too much about the particulars in Wisconsin. You all know those better than I do. But it's true also in Montana, where I live. It's true across the West. It's true across the U.S. I think there's something about the U.S. and our ethic of rugged individualism that makes us not want anybody to tell us what to do. So there is this tension between, let's call it, civil liberties and public health, a deep tension that needs to be talked about and needs to be resolved.
But there were mixed messages at the beginning of the pandemic about whether masks would be a necessary defense to COVID.
There were, absolutely. You're right. Even from Tony Fauci, who is a very good public health leader and scientist. He has explained his mixed messages on the basis that back in March or April, that we didn't have enough masks, particularly N95 masks, for healthcare workers. So he was telling people, look, you may not need masks yet. The public health workers need those masks. So don't rush too quickly to acquire a lot of masks and protect yourself, particularly when you're outdoors. So, but you're absolutely right. There have been mixed messages. There has been great confusion among particularly political leaders, but also among public health leaders, the CDC included. We've got mixed messages from the CDC.
And there's been a lot of finger pointing as well. I just want to bring up here Jim in Cedarburg, who emailed to ask about the possibility to point the finger at China. Did China release this virus to the world?
China, no, this is not an engineered virus, if that's what Jim means. The best evolutionary virologists in the world have published papers in the leading peer-reviewed journals in the world, debunking the idea that this is an engineered virus. The genome examination just does not support that. It refutes the idea that this was engineered. This was engineered by nature. But China has some things to answer for, absolutely. During the month of December, it seems that Chinese authorities knew that this was a very dangerous respiratory virus, even a coronavirus, that was spreading from human to human in the city of Wuhan. And they were slow to release that information. And that was a critical mistake, critical absence of transparency, lack of transparency on their part.
We're spending the hour with science journalist David Quammen about why animal diseases are infecting humans more frequently, why the spillover effects are a growing threat to global health, as well as economic and global security. We're unpacking it all. Are you worried about new diseases that could emerge? What do you think can be done about zoonotic diseases? Do you think COVID-19 is here to stay, or do you have faith in the vaccine? Be part of this at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We'll talk more with David Quammen after this news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. A quick heads up here on programming. President Trump and Joe Biden will meet in their first presidential candidate debate tonight at 8. We'll bring you live NPR coverage. This is the first of three scheduled debates, and it'll take place at Case Western Reserve University. That's live NPR coverage tonight at 8 on Wisconsin Public Radio and at WPR.org. Right now, as we see this rapid rise in COVID-19 infections and hospitalizations here in Wisconsin, we're discussing the spread of infections from animals to humans and the origins of past infectious disease outbreaks. Why are they becoming more prevalent? What does this mean for combating COVID-19? And when will the next pandemic strike? Conversation right here, 800-642-1234. We have science journalist David Quammen, who stays with us. David, you've been writing about this idea that the coronavirus came from pangolins. And can you first off explain what a pangolin is?
Yeah, a pangolin is, the loose name for it is scaly anteater. It's not actually an anteater, but it does have a long tongue and it eats ants and termites. It belongs to a different family of mammals. It's covered with scales like an armadillo. There are four species native to Africa, four species native to Asia, and they are all sorely endangered because of traffic in pangolins for food and to use their scales for traditional Chinese medicine.
What connections are you making there?
Well, scientists have been making connections. They have been finding coronaviruses, some of which are very similar to the COVID-19 virus, in pangolins, as well as in bats. So there is a lively discussion in the scientific literature right now, and I reported on it in my late August story in the New Yorker magazine on this. There's a lively discussion as to where this virus came from, which animal, which wild animal was its reservoir host. Was it bats? Probably. Over the long run, but did it perhaps pass from bats into pangolins for a period of evolution, decades, maybe 40 or 50 years, and then into humans? Because some of the pangolin coronaviruses closely resemble, they're not the exact same virus as this, but they closely resemble this in certain parts of their genome, but other bat coronaviruses resemble other parts of the genome of this virus. So it's a confused picture right now, but it's something that the scientists are looking into.
Have you ever seen one?
I have seen one time in southeastern Cameroon when I was researching my book Spillover. This poor pangolin was about to go into the kitchen at the hotel, the little hotel in this village where I was staying. A kitchen worker had bought it from the market, and he was about to slaughter it and serve it to somebody at this hotel. That's the fate of too many pangolins.
Let's bring in Vern now, joining us from Boyd. Hi, Vern.
Oh, hi. Good morning. Thanks for letting me on. Like I said, I did some research on this Nidus library too. This virus came out of a bat lab in Wuhan, China. And some woman named the Bat Woman, she's got a Chinese name, collected bats from a cave in Wuhan, China, took them to the Wuhan Institute of Virology, and this is a level 4 virus. That means it's airborne. They couldn't contain it. And they've been doing this since 2000 or so, because that's where SARS-1 came along from.
And Vern, let's let David respond to this notion that it came from a bat lab.
Yeah, Vern, with all due respect, that is a story that is going around on the internet, not in scientific literature, but rumor and paranoia on the internet has been spreading that story. The woman that you're talking about is Dr. Zhengli Shi. I was on a Skype call with her about 2 weeks ago. She does study coronaviruses. She has been warning over the last 10 years that there are the coronaviruses carried by bats that could be infectious to humans. She's been publishing those warnings in the scientific literature. She found a coronavirus that is 96% similar to this coronavirus. She was not growing it in her lab. She had the genomic sequences that she was studying in her lab. She was not culturing the virus, therefore no live virus of this sort could have escaped from her lab. And the 96% similarity represents, as I said earlier, about 40 to 50 years of evolutionary divergence. So that's an enticing story if you want to demonize a particular lab, but it just is not supported by the scientific evidence.
Not there. Let's bring in Greg now in Sheboygan. Greg, hi.
Hello, good morning. Yeah, I worked in microbiology and when you want the germs or the funguses to grow better or whatever, viruses, you're just in the incubator. When you're incubating the samples, when you're growing them from the sample you've taken from a person or from whatever, and you want them to grow better, you just increase the CO2 in the incubator. And that's what's happening on the Earth. And if we continue to do this, see, CO2 doesn't break down. Its bond energy is 394 kilojoules per mole. So in other words, to break 44 grams, you need to generate the energy necessary to push 87,555 pounds 1 meter. And nothing in nature, aside from coal formation, can concentrate the pressure down underground. It concentrates enough heat to break CO2, but otherwise it doesn't break. It mixes with water, and then if hydrogen's knocked off, yeah, that carbonic acid turns into a carbonate ion.
Okay, Greg, I'm gonna stop the science here for a moment and to ask a question here. Allison from Milwaukee may be asking a similar question about the rise of diseases due to climate change, due to factory farms, agriculture, deforestation. Should we be addressing these basic scientific issues and these types of questions?
Is she with us?
David? Yeah, David, can you hear us? Yeah, go ahead.
I can hear you, but I couldn't hear her.
Allison from Milwaukee had emailed in. She's not here. Right. Mm-hmm.
Okay, I thought we were going to hear her voice. Well, first of all, I agree with Greg. We've got too much carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. I can't match his knowledge of biochemistry, but absolutely, I take his point. Allison, climate change, yes, that certainly is a problem. I think we have three great problems on this planet: climate change, the threat of pandemic disease, and the loss of biological diversity, which is valuable for its own sake. They have the same ultimate causes, and there is some overlap between them. Climate change, for instance, is moving some disease vectors out of the tropics and moving them northward. So diseases like West Nile, which is transmitted by mosquitoes, is coming north. Zika virus is coming north. There are impacts in many, many ways, but our footprint on this planet, including the increase in carbon dioxide and climate change, is having a very adverse effect in numerous ways, including the increased threat of pandemic disease.
Talking with David Quammen, who's a science journalist, written extensively about zoonotic diseases, including the coronavirus that originated from animals. You can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. David, what role do open markets, what we've heard as called wet markets, have in the transmission of diseases like the coronavirus?
Right. Well, wet markets is the term applied to these food markets in in China and Southeast Asia, some in Africa, where wild animals are brought live, caged, for sale as food in stalls adjacent to, sometimes piled on top of, domestic animals, chickens and ducks, frogs, turtles, snakes, pigs. Pork is being sold, meat of various kinds, domestic meat is being sold, seafood. And these are ideal situations for viral mixing, for the passing of viruses from one kind of animal to another, from wild animals domestic to domestic animals, from wild animals directly to humans. It's not the only source of danger for zoonotic diseases, zoonotic viruses getting into humans, but it is certainly one of them. And there's a need to get a handle on those, to control or stop entirely the practice of bringing captured wild animals from the wild alive into food markets with other kinds of human food.
I still keep going back to the image of the pangolin going into the restaurant kitchen and just, you know, wondering, just what are the factors in safety protocols in slaughtering animals and what you need to be thinking about in order to ensure that there isn't any type of disease transmission?
Right, right. There is great danger from that because as we were saying earlier, as I was saying, pangolins carry coronaviruses, bats carry coronaviruses, other animals carry coronaviruses and other kinds of viruses, paramyxoviruses, influenza viruses, other viruses that can be very dangerous to humans. But it's not just the killing and eating of wild animals. It's coming in contact with them as we log the great tropical forest, as we establish timber camps in those forests, as we establish mines in those forests, producing minerals, some of which are essential for our cell phones and computers. So we all have a share of the responsibility for this. Every decision that we make in terms of what we eat, but also what we consume in other ways, what we wear, how much fossil fuel we burn, how many children we have, if we have children, all these contribute to the footprint of humans on the natural world. And that footprint squashes viruses out of their natural hosts and gives them the opportunity to get into humans.
It makes you think about the finger pointing going on, especially toward China, that we all have to look more inwardly at ourselves on our own consumption.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's one of the things I've been trying to remind people of. I have responsibility. You have responsibility. Kate, everybody has a bit of responsibility. If they've got a cell phone, if they've got a computer, if they eat meat, if they travel, if they have children, there's enough responsibility to go around. So finger pointing really doesn't get us anywhere unless you're pointing the finger also into the mirror.
Science journalist David Quammen has chronicled his work around the world investigating the origins of the spread of disease from animals to humans. He's our guide for the hour. Are you worried about new diseases that could emerge? What do you think can be done about zoonotic diseases? Still time to ask your question, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with David Quammen right here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation with science author David Quammen. We're learning why pandemics happen. The coronavirus pandemic has now killed at least 1 million people worldwide. And we reached this point just 9 months after the first reported fatality in China last January. David Quammen has been writing about the origin of infectious diseases and our consumption habits that are taking over the natural world. Let's take another call now. Dan is joining us from Wasakee. Hi, Dan.
Good morning. How are you? I would like to comment, first of all, that because most of us don't know anybody who's died or been hospitalized, a lot of people just don't take it seriously enough, you know? And because most of the people who die are elderly, and people think they hear all kinds of conflicting stories about people with pre-existing conditions amounting to 94% of the deaths. You know, it's a little bit confusing for people. But up here in northeastern Wisconsin, there are way too many people who don't pay any attention to masking or social distancing. And I've seen more people up here than I've ever seen before. The weekends, you'd think you're in Milwaukee or in Chicago or Green Bay. Up here in Waukesha, Wisconsin, a small town, you know, people camping and the bars are full. There's no social distancing. There's no wearing of masks. It's if it's a major problem, it's going to take a major reaction to suppress it.
David, in these small towns and in these tourist destinations as well, as Dan is setting a scene there, what has to happen for Americans to take this seriously?
Well, that's a good question, and that's a good statement from Dan. I agree with everything he said, and it's important for people to hear that. I live in a tourist town, too. I live in Bozeman, Montana, which is a gateway to Park. We had very, very few cases throughout the spring in Montana generally. You know, February, March, April, people are not, except for skiers, they're not flocking to Montana. But then it got to be summer and Yellowstone opened and people wanted to come west, and suddenly our case numbers went up considerably. What do you do about that? Some people here, many people here are wearing masks, but many people still are not. We've got a university that's open in Bozeman, Montana State University. What do you do about sensitizing people to the fact that this is real? I don't know, Dan. We have to spread the message that even though you might be young, you might feel invulnerable, you might be very frustrated with shutdowns, you might be longing to go to the bars and hang out with your friends, still you have to take this thing seriously. It might not kill you, but it'll kill your parents or kill your grandparents. It'll kill your uncle. It is a dangerous virus. It does kill, even though 99 out of 100 people may get through it. Young people suffer from it too, just not as many of them. So we have to take this seriously. We have to do the social distancing. We have to wear the masks in the appropriate situations. This thing is real. It's not going to go away magically.
Let's bring in Daryl now in Couderay. Hi, Daryl.
Yes, thank you for the program. As the virus continues to spread among us, is the problem really just too many Americans on vacation in Egypt swimming in the river of denial with the sitting president?
That's part of it. That's part of it, Daryl, for sure. We need better leadership. We need leadership that honors science and listens to public health. I don't want to get political here, but we desperately need to take science seriously. This disease, this virus is not a hoax. It is real. We need to listen to our scientists. We need to listen to people like Tony Fauci and Robert Redfield at the CDC. We need to abide by their recommendations. We need to develop a vaccine, but not rush a vaccine into production before it's been adequately tested.
I understand, David Quammen, you're working on a new book about the coronavirus. What do you hope to understand about it?
Well, one of the things I hope to understand is exactly where it came from and what human actions led to the spillover of the original virus from bats or pangolins or whatever animal it came from, why this virus has adapted so well to humans. I'm interested in the origins. But of course, I'm also interested in vaccine development. I'm interested in therapeutics. I'm interested in the science side of this. And other people are writing books that will focus on the political side of this and the public health measures that that need to be put into effect. My beat is science, so that's what I'll be focusing on, in particular when I can start to travel again. What I do is talk with scientists and walk through jungles and climb through bat caves. So when I can do that again, that's what my focus will be.
Let's bring in James now, who's joining us from Park Falls. Hi, James. What's your question?
Hi. My question was just kind of what he was just highlighting. I'm kind of stumped as far as the jump from human to animal. And if not, there's the SARS-CoV-2 factor in there. And I wanted to find out if this could correlate to anything from the 2019 World Military Games, which were in Wuhan, China, around October 18th. It was event 201. They had come up with some profiling as this a scenario, and what your guest opinion was on or would be on that.
Yeah, thanks, James. One of the things that we've learned is that the very first hospitalized case of this occurred on December 1st in Wuhan, and that person had no connection with the wet market, the famous Huanan wholesale seafood market. So that suggests that this virus was circulating naturally, probably as early as the month of November, possibly earlier. You mentioned October. It's possible that this thing had spilled over from a bat or some other creature, and that it was moving slowly and quietly through humans, transmitting not rampantly, but occasionally from human to human, causing some illness, maybe causing a death or two, and it wasn't yet recognized by authorities there. That's entirely possible. The military games might have been an occasion for spread, but this is not a weaponized virus, as I've said, and can't say too often. This is a virus that that comes to us courtesy of Darwinian natural selection, evolution in wild animals.
What do you see as our next defense here? And, you know, as you watch vaccine development and other fronts here on treatment, where do we go next to be able to get our arms around this, or will it just stay with us?
Well, vaccine development is absolutely important. I think we will have several vaccines as early as next year, certainly not in distribution this fall. Just can't happen that quickly, can't happen safely that quickly. But once we get a vaccine, that's no silver bullet. That's no panacea for this situation. We've got something like 40% of the American population that doesn't even want to be vaccinated, even if the vaccine were here. So we need to persuade people to trust science, to accept the vaccine, to get their kids vaccinated. That will help. But this virus, I think, and scientists that I trust think, is never going away. This is in the human population now. 30 years from now, I think children will be vaccinated against this virus, just as children are still vaccinated against measles. We've had a measles vaccine since the 1950s, but something like 140,000 people around the world still die of measles. So there's a possible model for what this thing will look like in the future.
David, thank you for joining us.
Kate, you're very welcome. Pleasure to talk with you. Pleasure to talk with your listeners. Have a good day.
You too.
Stay safe.
You too. David Quammen, veteran science journalist who's written about animal diseases, including coronavirus, that are infecting humans. He's the author of 16 books, including Spillover in 2012, about animal infections and pandemics. Just ahead, the census is up against a lot this year. There's a pandemic, wildfires out west, hurricanes, which make the already difficult but constitutionally mandated task of counting every person in the country even harder. 1A has the latest on the census's progress. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.